And you're welcome back to the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. It's Donal Kavanagh with you on the show for the next hour, into the final hour at the moment. Now, we're going to discuss the issue of eating orders, and specifically eating orders among men, because it's been determined that the number of men with eating disorders is far greater than was believed. We're joined on Zoom this morning by Ellen Jennings, who's communications officer with Bodywise. Ellen, good morning.
Hi, Donal. Thanks for having me on.
It's our absolute pleasure. A lot of people are going to be surprised by this funding. I read it on in my paper on Sunday, and I will be honest, I took a step back when I read that men make up 1 in 4 cases of eating disorders. I didn't expect it would be that high.
Yeah, that's a more recent figure. So historically, it would have been that 1 in 10 figure that we would have heard a lot about. And I think the reason that we're seeing more men speaking out about their experience is because the stigma that has existed around eating disorders being seen as a female illness is slowly being broken down, and more men are feeling able to open up about their experiences. Unfortunately, we're also seeing cases where men are not reaching out for help early on when they notice maybe something is not quite right with their relationship with food and their body. And that means that they're presenting more physically ill and at a more serious stage. And that can be difficult because it's very important to have early intervention when it comes to eating disorders. They're a very serious and complex mental health condition that it is possible to recover from with the right support and treatment. So it's important that people can recognize, you know, what the signs are that something might not quite be right, and to be able to talk about their experiences more openly.
Is it that traditionally the conversation about eating disorders would have been almost exclusively focused towards women, and there would have been a presumption that women would have been the people most affected by them, that the rise in men's eating disorders almost went under the radar?
Absolutely. Even when it comes down to the diagnostic criteria for an eating disorder, part of that criteria was around menstruation and periods. So obviously that wouldn't apply in this case. So it's important, I suppose, that doctors and health professionals are also aware that this is something that can affect men and women, boys and girls. You know, it doesn't have a look or an age or a gender. This is something that can affect anyone, and it can be very serious for the person, and it affects every aspect of their life. So it's very important that it is recognised.
There appears to be in some medical circles a lack of understanding of how to deal with this in men, and the lack of resources in how to deal with this in men. You know, we all laughed when we read that one man, when he was being diagnosed, was handed an information leaflet about periods, and because that's what you gave people with eating disorders. Now, I mean, on the one level, it's funny, but on the other level, it's very serious indeed.
Yeah, what we've heard from service users who have had experience of eating disorders maybe at some point in their life is that it felt very isolating and alone not to have other experiences talked about in, from a male perspective. So I think even for people who are experiencing something like this, to see someone speak out, we've heard multiple GAA players and other people who might be in the public eye come out and speak about their experiences, and things like that can be helpful for people to recognize that they're not alone in their experience, and that there are other people who have similar experiences and feel this way about their relationship with food and their body. And it's very complex as well. You know, no two eating disorders are the same. So the way it shows up for one person might be different to the way it shows up for someone else. So it's about breaking it down into what's really going on for the person, because the behaviours that you see on the surface really are just a symptom of what's going on for the person underneath.
Does it tend to be a different form of disorder in the case of men? Suggestion, maybe in men it's more binging followed by guilt more so than, say, a condition such as anorexia nervosa.
Anorexia nervosa can also affect men. We are hearing more about binge eating disorder, but what we would often say is that most of the eating disorders have more in common than they do different. So really, an eating disorder is a coping mechanism for the person. So it offers them a sense of control over some aspect of their life when maybe other aspects of their life feel out of their control. There are some aspects of eating disorders that may be more male orientated, where we're hearing more about a focus on muscularity as opposed to that focus on thinness. And that can be down to those body ideals that we're seeing for men and women. So when we think of what we're seeing in the media and social media, it's often this very muscular physique that is seen as the kind of body ideal for men. And that can be really difficult when you're in a place of comparison to these unrealistic ideals. We're also seeing that for men, there can be more of a compulsive exercise element to their eating disorder as well, and that can be really difficult to move away from. And I suppose when we think of it as a coping mechanism, it's about using other coping mechanisms then to move away from the control that the eating disorder has taken over the person.
Obviously, there's been a huge growth in the past number of years in private gyms and fitness centres and one-on-one training centres and so on. Is there perhaps an argument to be made that information and posters be, you know, disseminated through those particular areas because they're the sort of areas that maybe you're going to get through to the very people you need to get through to?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's important to raise awareness in those spaces, but there's no one cause for an eating disorder either. There are multiple risk factors, and there are things that are internal to the person as well as external to them in the environment around them and the world around them. So some people might not be affected, but others might be affected. So it's difficult, especially when we talk about the online environment as well. Like, there's so much information and content right at your fingertips that it's very difficult to avoid this content. And oftentimes people with eating disorders will seek out content that will affirm that what they're doing is the right thing to do. So I think it's very important that, you know, people who have a following or people who share content about fitness or nutrition information, etc., are doing so from an informed and professional space, and that they're aware of the impact that the messaging that they put across can have on members of society and people who might be at risk.
Are men seeking help? Because traditionally we're told men are a lot less likely to go to a doctor. They're a lot less likely to admit a potential problem than women are. So do we have an issue here that men are still not presenting, or is part of the reason for the rise maybe men being more inclined to go and seek help?
No, it's definitely in many studies we've seen that men are less likely to come forward about their experience. And I suppose in the past we would have talked about it as a double stigma, in that the person with an eating disorder may believe that it is a female illness, and that's not the case, but that's a stigma that's existed for a long time. So there's that stigma that might prevent a man from speaking about his experience. And then also a man with a mental health condition, we know they're less likely to seek help or go to the doctor to speak about their experience. So I think what's really important is that we are able to bring up conversations like this and to talk about the fact that this does affect men as well. We have our Eating Disorders Awareness Week coming up at the end of the month, the 27th to the 5th of March. And part of that week is all about breaking down that stigma and focusing on the fact that this is an issue that can affect men as well, with eating disorders and body image issues.
In the case of a man who believes he may have an eating disorder, is his first port of call the GP? Should he make contact with yourselves? Should he seek help online? What's the best route to take?
It can be really difficult to acknowledge that something's not quite right. And sometimes when someone is in the depths of their eating disorder, they can't actually see that something isn't quite right because it's working for them as a coping mechanism. So it can be really difficult for the person to move away from that. I would say the first step, if you recognise that something's not quite right, is to open up with someone that you trust. Maybe reach out to our support services and we can talk through what the next steps might be. And then usually the first step in getting started on that treatment and recovery journey is to go to the GP, who can look after the physical aspects of the condition, and refer on to a multidisciplinary team who can look after the other aspects of the condition.
Ellen Jennings, Communications Officer with Body Wise, thanks indeed for speaking to us this morning. It's something obviously we'll be keeping an eye on, and we would encourage anyone that believes they may have an issue, obviously, to go take that first step, seek help, and see where it goes from there. But definitely, if someone does have an eating disorder, the sooner they seek help, the sooner they can come to terms, not just with the disorder itself, but with the underlying conditions. And as you say, it's a coping mechanism, so that suggests there are underlying issues that perhaps are driving towards that, and maybe once we can attack those underlying issues, we have a better chance of actually addressing the eating disorder itself. Ellen, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Donal.
That's Ellen Jennings there, Communications Officer with Bodywise. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio with Donal Kavanagh. Just want to look at some of your comments. Connor says, my daughter is in secondary school. Mock exams are coming up. Now, my daughter's in second year, so she's not involved in state exams. She's been off for a week because of snow. Over the next 3 weeks, she has only 5 days in school with no teaching time because class tests will take place. The rest of the days, they're saying children need to stay home and study. How is this the case for the whole school? How is it okay for children to miss out on so much teaching time and also leaving pressure on parents to get childcare when they have full-time jobs? Then they have the audacity to take a midterm break for a week in February and a further 2 weeks off in April. I was never aware of people in non-exam classes being effectively sent home from school when the mocks were taking place. That certainly didn't happen when I was in school, but that was quite a long time ago. Another caller says, what myself and many people can't understand is why are so many people coming here from countries that there is no war in? Countries like Algeria, Albania, etc. Why has no TD asked a parliamentary question? How many people have come here with no papers, and how was that able to happen? There are questions posed by a caller. Caller says, after a Gartha was convicted of drunk driving and given a 3-year ban, some trust has been restored in the Gartha approach to the blight of drunk drivers on our roads. Let's hope this approach is extended to parts of rural Ireland without favour to anyone of certain esteemed positions or connections. So says a caller. I bought a bag of sticks to light my fire on a regular basis. It's a 3 kilo bag. It cost $3.49. Yesterday I thought it felt a bit light. I weighed it, 1.6 kilos. This is happening more and more. Businesses don't want to increase prices because you'll notice and shop elsewhere. So they're reducing the size of everything for the same money. That's a very interesting point. Now, if I go to buy a bag of kindling, I will buy a bag of kindling. I know how much a bag of kindling costs in the local place I buy it in. It doesn't, to my knowledge, claim to be a particular weight. I know certainly if you are selling something like petrol, that there is a weights and measures division of government that will regularly check to make sure that if you're paying for a litre of petrol, you're getting a litre of petrol. And if you're not getting a litre of petrol, then there is a major issue and there has been action taken against retailers over the years as a result of that. Now, if someone in a provider writes 3 kg on a bag and sells the bag and the bag weighs 1.6 kg. I'm not sure what the legal position is there. Are you buying a bag of kindling or are you specifically buying 3.5 kg of, or 3.5 or whatever kg of kindling? I don't know is the answer, but it's a very interesting question. And thank you, caller, for raising it. Food for thought, perhaps. But certainly, I mean, and you'll be told, for instance, that if you're buying anything, be it a bag of crisps or whatever, yes, it does appear that there's a lot more air and a lot less actual crisps in the bag. That's the way it appears these days. That's very true. Caller has written to Minister Charlie McConnellogue an open letter and has sent that letter to us. It's in regards to that ongoing Quilty issue. It's from Raymond in Convoy and it reads, Dear Minister McConnellogue, may I respectfully ask why you have decided to start the Landlords 2.0 with English landlords being re-invited to buy large swathes of land which the department would have purchased several decades ago for a mere £1 per acre? Why are good Irish citizens like myself not being given the opportunity to buy Irish forestry land? Quilche is apparently now the land-grabbing arm for the new English landlords. However, you carefully try to disguise this ugly truth. Do you not know your very painful history here in Donegal? You have restarted the land wars. That's a take on that ongoing situation. It's 20 past 11. Let's take a short break.
Watch the show live now on YouTube, Facebook and at highlandradio.com.
Welcome back to the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio with Donal Kavanagh. Not long left on the programme now. We're into the last 40 minutes or so. And we have two very interesting guests in studio with us this morning. We have Brian O'Driscoll, who is the Director of Pastoral Renewal in the Diocese of Raphoe. Brian, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
And we have Father Michael Carney as well, who is the Chair for the Council of Priests for the Diocese. Father Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Donal.
As part of the Diocesan Pastoral Plan, an attendance survey is to be carried out at Masses in the Raphoe Diocese over February to determine the future of Mass times and parish structures within the diocese. This is an interesting one, because we are told that as well as falling attendances, we also have falling numbers of priests. Are we looking at a situation, and I'll go to you first, Father Michael, on this. Are we looking at a situation where we're going to see some parishes effectively sharing priests, and the times of Masses and the frequency of Masses in each church reduced as a result?
I couldn't say that that is exactly the outcome of all of this, but if you were to go on what's happening in other dioceses in the country, that possibility is there. We obviously, like most other dioceses in this country, are experiencing what can only be said a shortage of manpower.
Yeah.
We have gone from, for example, I think 15 years ago we had something in the region of 64, 65 active clergy. We have now something in the region of 45, 48 active yeah. clergy. In other words, when either some of my colleagues die and go to God or retire, they're not being replaced, because we have very few seminarians. We have very few guys being ordained.
Yeah.
Say in the last 5-7 years, we've had one person ordained, and in that time we have had a number of guys retired, and a number of my colleagues sadly have died. So it's common sense that we look at and see what is happening on the ground. How are we to address the situation on the ground as regards the number of parishes, the number of churches, the number of priests, and what we are offering people.
Brian, from your own point of view, you're coming in as a Director of Pastoral Renewal, and you're being given the job, as it were, of trying to inject that new sense of renewal into the diocese, and that will hopefully have an impact on attendance and an impact on commitment in general. It's a challenging time, I suspect, to take on that job.
It is. It's a very challenging time, but it's a very exciting time as well. So just my own background, I began this role on the 1st of November last. So I'm a Cork man. My wife and my children and I, we moved up on the October bank holiday weekend and to take up this position. And it's like that. It's a very challenging time for the church, but it's these are changing times. And like everything, there is, even in the short amount of time that I've been here, going around the diocese, meeting different priests, meeting parishes, there's great hope. There's real great hope. A lot of, I suppose, green shoots on the ground, and a lot to work with. But saying that, like, we are facing a very, there are, I suppose, we're in rocky waters at the moment, so to speak, choppy waters. But at the same time, there is great, great hope. But it is a challenging position, that's for sure, yeah.
Is there a renewal of faith at the level of community? I mean, and we'll park the vocations issue just to one side yeah. for a moment, because, you know, we're told the church is the people of God, the church is the people, mm-hmm. the priests are there, you know, to facilitate the people, to facilitate the church. And sometimes people look at church and they see the church as the institution, and the priests and the bishop and, mm-hmm. and the pope, and that's the church. Whereas I think the model that you're mm-hmm. presumably trying to push is that the church is actually the people. The church starts in the community, and then the job of the clergy is to facilitate that.
Yeah, most definitely. I guess part of this plan has been, and this began before I came on, was the formation of parish councils all around the diocese. And there's a wonderful man that comes from the diocese of Down O'Connor, Jim Deeds. He's a facilitator, facilitates the training and the formation of these parish councils. And they meet at deanery level. So there are 6 deaneries in the diocese of Raphoe, and each parish, majority of parishes are represented at each of those. Now, I go along with Jim to these meetings, and it's absolutely amazing. It really is. It's there's such an enthusiasm, and it's the lay people standing up, taking ownership, realizing that, you know, the even the future of the parish very much relies, I guess, on their participation and them stepping up to the game. And you can see that right now across the diocese, even here in terms of youth. And I know there's a lot of work to do in the youth formation. Even here in Letterkenny, for example, there's some fantastic youth meetings here on a Wednesday and Thursday night down the cathedral and over in the pastoral centre. And, you know, okay, it's you might only have 20, 25 young people coming from across the diocese, but, you know, even to see the different backgrounds they're coming from, their enthusiasm, it's something to work with.
Yeah. Okay, I, from my own point of view, I do sing in the church choir. I sing in the church of the Irish Martyrs Choir, and as a result, I have sung with you, Father Michael, because you're very involved in church music, as people know, with St. Junan's and so on and so forth. So that's one area that, you know, there's the ministry of music and there's ministry of reading. But sometimes it seems, when it comes to something like a parish council, it's the same people the same people are reading, the same people are involved in the church, the same people are joining the parish council, the same people are, you know, doing the work in the parish. Are we getting any evidence in this? And I know there's been a huge push towards parish councils and so on and so forth. Are we getting any indication that there are new people coming forward, or are you seeing the same faces you've always seen?
Yeah, I agree with you. Anything you want to get done in a parish, anything you want to do in a parish, you have the usual very generous-minded volunteers who are always coming forward. And thank God that they do come forward, because it means that we have that, if you like, that seam of volunteerism still in our parishes. But as to new people coming along, I think what Brian is saying is that you have people coming forward and that there is an enthusiasm there, which is good to see. And I sometimes think that perhaps we haven't cast the net out in the way that we should have. You talk about models of parishes, models of doing things. You would still have a degree of reliance on the priest and the few people who do everything, and people saying, well, that's, you know, they'll do it, they'll handle it, they'll sort it out. And not realizing that they have a charism themselves, that they could make a really good, wonderful and positive contribution through all the creativity that they have at their disposal. And it's up to all of us working together to try and tap into that and bring that out and draw that out from people. You know, I often think there's so much giftedness almost hidden in plain sight on front of us, and it's a question of how can you tap into it? How can you get people to respond? And I think this is one of the ways that we are finding that people are coming forward through this engagement that we have with these meetings that are going on at the moment.
One of the things, and the new emphasis on community and so on, one of the things you hear more and more from people is, oh, I'm involved, I have faith, but I don't go to Mass. Mm. And is that more and more coming an issue? And is there some form of model whereby people can be active in their parish without necessarily going to the church every Sunday? Or in your view, and I know from a theological point of view, and you have to take that view as well, in your view, is the Mass still the core of everything?
Well, we are a Eucharistic church. The Eucharist is the summit and source of everything we do as Christians, as specifically Catholics. Without that Eucharist, I just wonder what do we have. However, I'm always reminded of Pope Paul VI's little line that there are more ways to God than just the usual way that we map out for people. I'm sure people find their way to God in other ways, and
I'll always, as you rightly say, I'll always put forward the fact that Eucharist and Mass, they're the most important things about our faith, and all of what we're doing at the moment is will be to ensure that that is there for people and people have access to that, and that we continue to be a Eucharistic church.
Brian, you're not nodding there. Obviously, you see your view as the director of pastoral renewal. You've got to work within, as Father Michael said there, within that model that does say that the Mass is at the centre and everything radiates out from that. This is not a matter of identifying a new centre, you know, or identifying a new model. That still very much this is that model of that practicing Catholics will go to Mass first and foremost and then take it from there.
Yeah, well, look, even if we look at, we go back to Vatican II, you look at there's some beautiful doctrines came from that, and one of the key things was, look, the Eucharist is the source and summit of the Christian faith. And look, as Father Michael said, we're a Eucharistic church, that everything comes from the Eucharist. But even in saying that, one of my roles is to get adult faith formation going programs across the diocese. And even in that, right now, it's not being run by me, it's being run by Father Philip Kemmy of the parish in Newtown Cunningham on a Monday evening in the Pastoral Centre here in Letterkenny, an RCIA programme. Mm-hmm. And that's people who are very interested in learning more about the Catholic faith from other denominations and interested to come in. So there's plenty of ways for people on the outside, so to speak, to come in. The doors are always open. But I suppose to get back to your point, I guess we are a Eucharistic church. Yeah.
The survey. Talk to me about the mechanics of the survey. How is it going to be done? Are people literally being counted as they walk in? Are people being asked to fill in forms? Are people being interviewed? What sort of information are you hoping to get out of this process? And where does it go from there on the basis of the information you have?
Yeah, so the survey, it's going to take place over a 3-week period. It's going to take from the first week will be Monday the 13th of February to Sunday the 19th, then Monday the 20th to Sunday the 26th, and the final week will be Monday the 27th of February to Sunday the 5th of March. And basically, we're not taking anyone's personal details or anything like that. It's literally going to be a survey of, you have Mass times, number attending, church capacity, things, even the participation of the laity from the welcome team, altar servers, lay readers, lay Eucharistic ministers, children's liturgy of the word, all this kind of thing, music, activity, whether it's prayer groups, Eucharistic adoration, the times of confessions, all that. And then there's also the whole demographic information within the parish to get the average age. And again, you're not asking people, I guess you're just kind of, that's going to be a little bit of a guess, just an estimate. Parish baptisms, weddings, funerals, just trying to find out, how in a lot of cases, how overworked a priest, how much help they need and all that. So right now, this is going to be a data collection exercise, I guess. And after that, there's going to be the Diocesan Pastoral Council with the Bishop, they're going to form a working body, and that's going to be comprised of the Council of Priests, the Vicar Friends in the Diocese, people from the different deaneries and parishes, and then they'll review the information after that. Right now, we haven't begun that survey. That's going to begin on Monday the 13th, so it's after that information comes back, then that'll be reviewed and we'll see from there.
And then that does bring up then the question that we posed at the start. Are we likely to see, in some cases, some masses cut, perhaps masses centralised, and perhaps a situation where a priest more and more we'll just take an example, and I don't want to take any, actually I don't want to name towns because people will think I'm talking specifically about themselves, but I mean, you may get sort of two adjoining towns where you may end up with a situation where the one priest will do both towns, and there'll be one 11 a.m. mass in town A, and then there'll maybe be a vigil mass in town B. I know certainly I'm going to go back to Waterford, which is where I'm originally from. My home church would have been a church in Waterford City. There used to be 3 masses on a Sunday morning, now there are 2. My wife's church is one of those parishes that have 2 churches, one on either side. And if you want rivalry, there is no rivalry like the rivalry within the parish between Church A and Church B. That's the essence of rivalry. Yeah. They're about 3.5 miles apart. You know, walk from one to the other in less than an hour. Yeah. But you want rivalry, that's where you have it. But they now have a situation where they're in a rural parish close to Tremor. You now have a situation where there is no priest, in her home parish. You have priests will come from Tremore. They do a vigil mass in her local church. They do a 9 a.m. mass in the other church. So there is no Sunday mass in one church. There's no vigil mass in the other. And it's a priest from the town of Tremore, which is nearby, is actually doing both. Are we likely to see that here in the future?
I think you probably will see that at some stage. Yes, there's no point in me saying no, because that has been the experience of, as you say, in your own part of the world, Waterford and Lismore. I'm just thinking of my colleague Niall Call, who was ordained a bishop just last week. He's going into a situation in Kilkenny, which is a bigger population than our diocese, where he has 27 priests. Yeah. We have 45, 48 active priests. So that situation, obviously, where you have less people to go round, well, then you are talking about having less masses, having perhaps, I don't know yet, we're at the preparatory stage of this, but perhaps, yes, you could have priests dealing with one or more parishes in the course of the next number of years, yeah.
And of course, the difference geographically between Ossory and Raphoe is Raphoe has a much larger landmass.
Absolutely.
So you're talking a much longer distance between churches. I mean, Ossory, it's a fairly small, you know, geographically, it's smaller. As you say, population-wise, it's bigger, but geographically, it's smaller. Whereas Raphoe, because of its sheer size, that throws its own problems. Because, as I say, in the case I'm talking about, the two churches in my wife's home parish and the church in Tremore are probably no more than 7 miles apart.
Yep.
I mean, here, if you had a similar situation, you might have three churches being serviced, but they could be 25, 30 miles apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think many of us will be buying electric cars. Let's put it like that. For example, in my own part of the world, Remelton, Kilmacrenan, Milford, Rathmullen, there are 5, 6, 7 churches in that area, in that small, small area. Yeah. And I know all of that has to be looked at, and has to be looked at against the background of declining numbers. We are not numerically available anymore, and we're not being replaced. It's as simple as that, and you have to be hard-headed about how you approach the problem. The overriding issue, come back to what we were talking about earlier, we're a Eucharistic church, can we continue to give our churches masses over the next number of years? This plan is geared towards all of that and more besides.
And obviously you'll be praying for vocations as well, and hoping that does happen. As a Eucharistic church, that will be part of it. We have to say that. We could talk for a long time, and I know a lot of people are interested in this. There's one survey has come in, and it says that this February survey isn't very fair, as in our church we only have evening mass every other month. So how can this be fair when we don't have a February evening mass? And I suppose this is an issue whenever you time it, you know, that there are going to be issues. But all we can say is, look, it's an interesting one, and we'll be looking with interest to see what happens. But in the meantime, Brian O'Driscoll and Father Michael Carney, thank you both very much indeed for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Donald.
The best of music on your station.
Now, if you were listening to the news with Michaela or Donna Marie earlier today, you will have heard that Donegal County Council debated the issue of modular homes for those whose homes are affected by defective blocks. It happened during a plenary meeting of council that took place in Lifford yesterday evening. The motion was raised by Councillor Gerry McMonagall that the council immediately put forward a proposal on the use of modular homes and send that proposal to the minister. We heard from Councillor Martin McDermott, who chairs the council's Defective Block Redress Committee, that Minister Dara O'Brien requested that such a document be presented. Now, at the meeting yesterday, the council's housing director seemed to be reluctant to do so. Now, I'm joined on the line by Councillor Jerry McMonagle, who, as we said, moved that motion on modular homes yesterday. Jerry, you weren't particularly happy with the initial response you got from council.
No, I wasn't, Donal. And I was right not to be happy. I think, you know, this we're all in this together, and we talked in the council about being united and putting a united front going forward to represent and help and support those families who are affected by the effect of concrete blocks. And you know, we're not asking, I wasn't asking the council yesterday to build modular homes. I know we haven't got the capacity. I know our housing department is under extreme pressure. I work with them on a daily basis. I understand all that. But like was said, the minister did ask for, if there was proposals, to bring them forward, put them on his desk. And what I'm asking the council to do, because we have a skill set within the council. We have architects, we have planners, we have engineers. You know, we have land banks. We have access to other lands that we're currently looking to purchase, where we can put together a proposal, a cost proposal to the department, outlining the cost and benefits of modular homes for those, at the minute, over 1,000 applicants whose houses are depreciating every day, and it's taking an inordinate length of time for this scheme to open up properly. And when it does, there's going to be a tsunami of further applications, and all the while, houses are depreciating.
The point was made. The point was made at the meeting by Pascal Lafferty, who is the head of housing within Donegal County Council, that other schemes which are based around Pyrite or the new apartment scheme, they're delivered by government agencies. They're delivered nationally. This scheme as it stands is being delivered by Donegal County Council. And the Donegal County Council is stretched as it is, and no one knows that better than you in terms of delivering what services it can, in terms of trying to liaise with the government and the department and things like trying to get the regulations even published. So if Donegal County Council is given even more to administer, the fear would be that the council would just not be able to cope, particularly if Minister Dara O'Brien turns around and says, Donegal County Council, that's an interesting proposal, you administer it.
Yeah, and look, and Donal, I accept that. And we've been saying from day one that this scheme was far, far bigger than what Donegal Council could possibly do. And it does need a housing agency approach. It does need a national approach. And it does need to start to get it off its backside and start doing a bit more for the people of Donegal. I think it's, you know, at times I'd be lost for words in relation to, I'm really glad that the people in the apartments in Dublin have got a scheme that is going to take them through the whole process. But we are here in Donegal. We've been in a process for a long number of years, negotiating with the department, with the ministers and different ministers along that way. And every step of the way, it's the onus has been put on the homeowner. And the council then have been the patsy in the middle. This needs to stop. We need to be treated the same as everybody else up here in Donegal. And there's no reason why the department and the minister has the power to do this, to initiate a scheme where modular homes can be put in place by the department and managed by the department, and let the people who have the defective concrete block homes have some escape from the mental anguish that they must be going through, and wondering, is this house going to fall down, and where can I get a house to meet my children today? Because they're not there, don't know.
Yeah.
They're just not there.
People can read the response you got. We have a story on this up on our website, and you can actually read the full response that was presented to Councillor McMonagle yesterday. It's on the website, but the first line of that response effectively said that from the council officials' point of view, there isn't a demand for modular homes in Donegal, that people's choices are either purchasing or renting mobile homes, making arrangement with families, or securing accommodation through the private rental sector. And according to the housing department of Donegal County Council, they are the three preferred options that they're coming across when they speak to people with defective homes. I take it from your response to that at the meeting yesterday and since, you're hearing differently.
Yeah, and many other councillors along with me. A Donegal senator suggested that was the case in the Shannon during a talk and a debate on the defective blocks, and he was lambasted from that day to this for suggesting such an outcome. That's not what's happening. That's not what people of defective, owners of defective homes are telling me, what the MAG Group have been asking for. And the MAG Group have, on several occasions, pleaded with the Minister to consider modular homes. So I don't know. That there really threw me when the Council suggested that. And I don't know who put together that response. And I've read that response a number of occasions since the meeting yesterday, because we only got that response 20 minutes before the motions were taken, Donal, which wasn't long enough to digest that full comprehensive response. But I wonder, was it someone from Donegal who actually put that response together? Because it was full of contradictions. And the other one sentence, they were saying they were willing to help and assist as every way that they can. And another, the two lines in, as you suggested there now. So I don't know where it was coming from, that response, but I know one thing. If all the members are in agreeing with the motion, when you talk privately to the management, I feel they also understand and would agree with the general flow of that motion. What their problem is the pressures they're under, and I understand that. But why can't they? Look, we get consultants in for everything. We can't build a road or a roundabout or a footpath for that matter unless we get a consultant in, despite us having road designers within the council. So, look, we go out to consultants all the time, and the scheme of this scheme and the amount of money that's spent, a consultant's really put together this, and we have the information within the applications, put it together, cost it, and we're not asking for hundreds of modular homes, we're asking for a number of modular homes to help and assist this scheme as it gets rolled out and to help the families.
You had your motion seconded yesterday at the meeting by Councillor Martin McDermott. That was a very deliberate decision on your part and his to do that, to demonstrate that there is cross-party support for this issue, that this isn't a political issue being moved by Gerry McMonagall of Sinn Féin. This is an issue across the board.
Yeah, exactly, going far from it. And it was a conscious decision. I worked very closely with Martin and other members in the council on a wide range of issues, but particularly on the defective block scheme. We are trying our very, very best to get the best that we possibly can as quick as possible for those families who are suffering as a result. Something that they had no act or part in. And we work where we can. We work very closely together. I contacted Martin and asked him, would he consider, not a problem, Jerry, of course I will. And Martin made a reference yesterday when he was talking on the motion about the cross-party support is there. And that was to show the council management, to give them support as well, to show that the full council, elected council, is in favour of this motion. And we're requesting you now, as the management, as a corporate body of Donegal County Council, to put this proposal together and put it on the minister's desk ASAP.
Indeed, I did speak to Councillor McDermott in Lifford yesterday at the meeting. You can hear what he had to say on the website again. And as I said, you can read that response that Councillor McMonagall is referring to there, because, as you said, it's a long and it's a detailed response, and it does, I think, deserve to be read and digested. The situation that now stands is that the motion has been passed by Donegal County Council. It sits as a passed motion, as an instruction effectively from the members, who are the board of directors of Donegal, as it were, to the chief executive and the management of Donegal PLC, to now prepare that document, prepare that proposal, and put it on the minister's desk as he requested. Are you hopeful that that will be done, and it will be done quickly?
Yeah, and I can assure you, in the coming days, I will be talking to the other party group leaders within the council, and with council management, to see how we can proceed with this motion and put it forward, and understanding the difficulties that our council management are under in relation to staffing levels, etc., etc. I think this is such an importance in the county that we need to be, because the people who are in these homes are going through enough mental anguish, as I said earlier, and we need to help and support them in every way we can and take some pressure off them. So I'll be looking to meet with the group leaders, to go and meet with the management, who we have regular meetings with, and really push this case and make it a strong case and get the management and give the management of our council the support that they need to put together a proposal. And if it means going outside to get consultants in, then I'm sure that we'll get the support of the members to allow that to happen.
And of course, the general issue that has to be discussed as well is, you're still waiting for the regulations from the minister. We're still waiting on clarification on issues issues like foundations, will they be included in the redress scheme? And all the while people are still waiting, and that's the context in which this discussion is taking place, and it's the context within which Donegal County Council is trying to administer a scheme, the details of which it doesn't know, that very much the officials themselves are scrambling in the dark.
Yeah, and look, this is a massive scheme, and it is taking far too long. I don't understand what the hold up are with government. These regulations should have been brought in last year. They should have been all passed, done and dusted, and we should be moving towards a 100% redress scheme. What we have at the minute, I don't think anybody really knows. We don't know how it's going to pan out because it hasn't been implemented. The regulations aren't there. There's all these, they're talking about amendments and all. I know my party are going to bring forward an amendment bill to the Dáil in the coming months, and it's about trying to get that 100% redress, to get it up and running. But the problem and what we need to watch here is because we have 1,000 social housing tenants whose houses are also affected. And we can't make a difference between those in social housing and those in private homes. We're all citizens of Donegal. We all have, you know, some of our members' houses are affected, some of our family members' houses are affected, and some are in social housing, some have their own homes. We cannot make a difference between them. They all must be treated equally and at the same time, and we help to support it. So whatever we can do as a council, because the onus is on us as a corporate body here, as left with the welfare and the running of this county, to ensure that all our citizens in the county are treated equally, and that's making no difference between those in social housing and those in private housing. We need to go to government now with that proposal and ensure that modular homes can be put in place. We support those who can't, because I see they talked about mobile homes. Mobile homes aren't going to suit everybody. It will suit some, and people will make alternative and be lucky enough to get private rented. But it's for those people who haven't got the wherewithal to get that private rented, and also who would not suit living in a mobile home for a long period of time, especially those who have mental or physical disabilities. So it's imperative on our council now to do the right thing, put forward these proposals and let the minister then make a decision on it. That's Donegal County Council.
Councillor Jeremy McMonagle, thank you very much indeed for that. That's Councillor Jai, thank you. And as I said, you can hear from Councillor Martin McDermott, who seconded that motion, and you can read the Council's response, and that's available on our website. Just a few comments before we go. Caller says, I can't believe that man, and this is a reference to Martin earlier on, who was having difficulty securing accommodation, can't believe that man was told to give up his job in order to get a house. What kind of message is this sending out? Is it any wonder employers can't get workers? Why work if you're better off at home? It's a disgrace. Caller says, I do a weekly shop in Supervalue in Carndonagh. I always find the staff really friendly and helpful. There are secondary students working there as well as older staff. Shopping is a pleasure. Delighted to hear it. Hope that's the experience in other places as well. Is it possible that government pension funds are tied up in any way with this Caoilte English Vulture Funds land grab? It's possible. I would take it. I would have thought that the amounts would be relatively small when you're talking in terms of the amount of money that a pension fund would be handling. It's a relatively small thing in that context, but it may well be an issue. We need more protests against the sale of land. Irish citizens are sitting too far back in allowing this to happen. Ireland has a minister in the county handing over land for pension funds. That's another comment being made by a caller there. It's a sin, making a mockery of Caoilte and other landowners, giving Irish soil to English companies, typical government money grabbers. Caller just says the narrow road past the Greenland Fort toward Killay, there's a very big and deep hole in the road on the right hand side. It could cause a serious accident. The county council have been notified drivers should approach with caution. And a caller said, I had a scam message from someone claiming to be from AIB. Due to unusual activity, your card has been placed on hold. Please visit AIBverifyonlineuser.com and follow the on-screen instructions to activate. Caller says, I suspect it's a scam, largely because I don't have an AIB card. Caller says, listening to the Irish about people coming into this country, who in Donegal doesn't have a son or daughter in America, Canada, Australia or Britain? Get a grip, folks. We always emigrated for economic needs. I, for one, am in favour of allowing people into this country, help us see new skills and cultures that we otherwise would never experience. Caller says, if I rent land, if the owner told me he was going to sell it next week, it would disrupt my business, so we have a rolling contract. When I pay in December, it locks it in for the next 2 years. Then next December, after payment, the contract rolls another year. It gives me 2 years to find an alternative if he wants to sell, and also gives him 2 years to find a new tenant if I want out. Security for both parties. Why can't residential contracts have a similar arrangement? Councillor says, Donegal County Council plans to hold a Women's Equality Day when the 33 male and 4 male council numbers will be reversed. This is nothing more than a stunt if our male politicians were serious on gender equality. Why didn't Councillor McGarvey lead by example and co-opt a woman in his place instead of a man? Well, I would have thought it's a deeper issue, perhaps, than outgoing Councillor Ian McGarvey. Finally, caller says, not sure if this is the right place to send this. I went to the emergency department with a letter from my doctor. I arrived at 9:30 on Monday. It's now Tuesday morning. I'm still sitting in the same seat, having been admitted. I've been told there are no beds. 24 hours I've now been waiting. But the worst thing is there's an old man sitting beside me most of the day. Again, he was told there is no beds. He's in pain and ended up lying on the floor. It's awful what this world is coming to. I heard last Friday there were no patients on trolleys in Letterkenny. Seeing firsthand in the past 24 hours, that's because all the patients are being admitted and left to sleep on chairs and wheelchairs. It's beyond a joke. Now, if a patient, I mean, those figures are counted. If someone is sitting in the emergency department, whether or not they're on a trolley, if they are in the emergency department, they are counted in those figures as they should be. And that's it for the 9 till noon show. Thank you to Caroline for producing and for keeping me right as always. Most importantly, thanks to you for listening. Thanks to all our contributors. John Breslin is up next around the Northwest.